Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt. This is episode CXL, A Ridiculous Waste of Time. Not the topic, to be clear, that's a direct quote from Herodian. Severus Alexander comes from a strong military dynasty, with a string of victories against Rome's enemies, and it's fair to say that the Roman army was less than impressed with his performance against the Sasanian and Germanic tribes. The empire needs a leader. Should they turn to a fighter, or to a weakling and his mother? Here's Kaelin Davenport.
Severus Alexander receives messages, according to Herodian, from his governors along the Rhine and Danube frontiers. And the message said that the Germans, in this case we're dealing with the Alemanni, had crossed the rivers and had invaded Roman territory.
Was this opportunistic on their part while the Romans are being distracted by the Persians, or is it just a coincidence of timing that they do this?
It's difficult to know. The movement of the Alemanni could have been prompted by several reasons. They could be in search of new land to farm. It could be that they were just intent on plundering, or it could be that population increase north of the Rhine had driven people into Roman territory in search of lands to settle there. So it's very difficult to reconstruct their motivations and how much they actually knew about the problems on the eastern frontier.
All right, so what do we know about Alexander setting out then? Was it the same scale of operation?
Yes, so we know very little about the German campaign compared to the Persian campaign. It's probably a campaign that was focused on the two German provinces, Germania Superior, Germania Inferior, Noricum and Raetia. So that would be modern-day Germany, Switzerland, Austria. This is the area we're looking at. Severus Alexander and his mother, once again, set out in 234. Medallions were created to commemorate the departure of the imperial retinue. It's probable that several senatorial consulars travelled as well. We know this from Herodian's references to them after his death. And so Severus Alexander and his court set up residence at Mogontiacum, which is modern-day Mainz, which is a legionary establishment. And they constructed a bridge across the Rhine, Herodian tells us, made up of strapping boats together to form a pontoon. And then
old school.
Yes. Herodian says that Severus Alexander was cowardly, didn't want to go to the frontier again.
Although he loathed the idea, Alexander glumly announced his departure.
yes. You know, he doesn't like warfare. Once again, this probably obscures some of the real preparations which were made. We know that Alexander had Osroenian archers from the east, as well as Mauritanian troops, as well as the legions that were stationed in Germania Inferior and Germania Superior. However, Alexander does not want to fight against the Germans, so he decides to buy peace rather than fight in order to conclude the campaign speedily. Herodian says in 6.7.9 that Alexander told the Germans that he had plenty of money, and so he was happy to buy them off.
That would not have impressed the army very much.
Not at all. Indeed, Herodian says in 6.7.10, the soldiers bitterly resented this ridiculous waste of time. In their opinion, Alexander showed no honourable intention to pursue the war and preferred chariot racing and a life of ease when he should have marched out to punish the Germans for their previous insolence.
So essentially the worst virtues of a bad emperor, really. Somebody more interested in games and pleasures and, yeah.
Exactly. So, and I think it reflects the portrait of Alexander and Herodian's narrative that he's more at home in the city than on the frontier.
So thus ends the Germanic War?
Yes, because there's a revolt.
Great episode. Thanks.
Yeah, yeah.
Next time on Emperors of Rome.
I'm sorry. We need to kill him off first. There's a revolt, and they decide to proclaim one of their own as emperor.
This is a first, isn't it?
We need to distinguish between senatorial legates and generals, people like Trajan, Septimius Severus. They're all senatorial generals who are able to make a play for the purple because of their armies, and they're qualified as senators.
This guy, yeah.
The new emperor is someone called Gaius Iulius Verus Maximinus. Now, a lot has been written about Maximinus, a lot of it inaccurate. He is portrayed by later 4th century sources and Herodian himself as a half-barbarian, a hulking brute, as it were, and also the first of the soldiery to become emperor. And we can talk more about the reception in his own episode.
Mm-hmm.
But what I would say here is that he's actually an equestrian officer. So he's not as high as Macrinus was, Praetorian prefect, but he's still an officer. He's not a common soldier. And he was, in antiquity, nicknamed Thrax the Thracian. But Ronald Syme, the famous Roman historian, has shown he was actually not from Thrace, but Moesia. So he's probably someone whose family or he himself obtained citizenship from a governor, then entered the equestrian officer ranks, possibly by being promoted from the ranks, which happened at this time. We don't know. But when he claims power now in 235, he is the prefect of recruits in charge of training men for the army.
Okay, I'm biting myself back from asking follow-up questions.
Sorry,
about
yes.
Him,
but yeah.
Suffice to say that he was very different, polar opposite to Severus Alexander.
Yes. Whatever we say, he is someone who has the support of the troops, is a military man. Herodian dramatizes this by saying that Maximinus has Andrea. He has bravery. He has manliness as opposed to Severus Alexander. So in Herodian's narrative, we find the army staging a revolt and basically telling Maximinus, you're going to become emperor whether you like it or not. He can either accept the purple or face the consequences himself. And I think Herodian's description here is actually quite insightful. And this is Herodian 6.8.6. Maximinus's first reaction was to refuse and throw off the purple cloak. But when they insisted at the point of the sword, threatening to kill him, he preferred to avoid the immediate danger rather than one in the future and accepted the honour. This is what we find happening in the 3rd century, is that armies in a particular place in the empire, usually engaged on a campaign, don't like their present general, whether that be an emperor or a governor, and they think someone else could do a better job. And they basically say to another person, their candidate, you could become emperor or we'll kill you. Faced with that, Herodian says that Maximinus preferred to avoid the immediate danger rather than one in the future. Yes, he could be killed as emperor, but he's going to take his chances there.
Yes, it's almost like who could blame him for doing what he did?
Exactly.
Yeah. And honestly, if he said no, they just would have gone to somebody else.
It's exactly. They would have killed him and someone else would have taken the throne.
Suffice to say, he takes them up on their offer and Severus Alexander's killed.
Yes. So Herodian is a master storyteller. Whatever his accuracy, he tells the story so well. Alexander is flustered. He's panic stricken, but he goes out to address the troops. However, the troops start to criticize them. They criticize his Praetorian prefect, his mother and her avariciousness, for example, and the fact that she's not sharing the money with the soldiers. At the same time, Alexander's haranguing the troops. Maximinus's army comes into sight, ready to overthrow Alexander. They call out, abusing Alexander, calling him a penny-pinching little woman himself, or Herodian in the Whitaker translation, that's given as the mean little sissy. And they also say that he's a cowardly boy enslaved to his mother. Mm. You know, this is a man in his late 20s. They're showing him not to be a man and still enslaved by his mother. He goes to Mamia, he clings to her and weeps and blames her for all his misfortunes.
So he proves their point.
Well, the way it is dramatized in Herodian, certainly. The detachment comes into the tent. They kill Severus Alexander, Julia Mamia, and his friends and most of his advisors.
So it's just a bit of a bloodbath there.
It is. It's a shocking scene there. Mm. You know, to think of the Roman emperor and his mother and advisors all slaughtered in a tent on the German frontier. Mm. It's a pretty dreadful story. It's interesting. Zosimus tells this story but places it in Rome, which is clearly wrong. So you get the sense that there were still different versions floating around that what happened. But Severus Alexander ended his life in an army camp in Germany.
And you know, true to his form, as always, Herodian ends it by being quite hard on Severus Alexander's mother. It is therefore entirely possible that the reign of Alexander might have won renown for its perfection had not his mother's petty avarice brought disgrace upon him. So he lays a lot of blame on the mother's doorstep.
Definitely. So she's essentially what stops him from becoming a man, an emperor in his own right, in Herodian.
This relationship that Severus Alexander had with his mother, does it come across in other sources? Because you get lines like, you know, the empire was managed by a woman's authority and everything like that coming out in Herodian. He is very hard on her. So is there any way to rehabilitate what was going on there between them?
It's very difficult. In all our other sources, Mamia looms over Alexander as the guiding force and not in a good way.
I guess she's even on coins and medallions and everything, so it's hard to say that this isn't something that's going on.
She was clearly an integral part of the regime. The historian Augusta, although generally positive towards Alexander Severus, calls him Alexander of Mamia. and says many people call him this.
Sorry, that's very funny.
Yes, yeah. You know, in Roman nomenclature, you're son of your father, not of your mother. Yeah. The historian Augusta calls her virtually their co-emperor. She's avaricious and greedy for gold and silver. And it's this idea that Mamia hoarded money, she was greedy, she kept it from the troops, is found in all our other sources. So the Epitome De Caesaribus, a 4th century source of little biographies about the emperors, generally only about a paragraph long, says that Mamia recycled uneaten food from banquets for use at future meals.
See, now we just admire that.
Yes, exactly. Yes, that's what they call that.
Leftovers.
Leftovers, thank you. Yes.
Leftovers, you were probably thinking, simpler. What's the Latin for leftovers?
Yes, there's actually some sophisticated term here. It's interesting that in the Emperor Julian's Caesares, so an account of previous emperors, Alexander is heckled for being unable to control his mother and giving her all his money. So even a later emperor remembered Severus Alexander in this way.
So I wonder if this is accurate or if it's just a gross exaggeration.
Yes, I mean, it's clearly that they were all relying on this same image of the young boy who had a powerful mother.
Mm.
So the idea that an emperor enslaved his mother was not a good one.
Herodian doesn't mention what happens posthumously, but the Historia Augusta does have a few details. So can you tell me about that? And I'm wondering if there's any truth to these elements.
The Historia Augusta in section 63 says that the Senate deified Severus Alexander and gave him a tomb in Rome. Now, this is the only evidence for Severus Alexander being buried in Rome. Firstly, you know, his body would have to be retrieved and sent back there.
Likelihood?
Quite low. It used to be identified with the mausoleum of the Monte di Grano, but that's probably not the case. That's probably a second century mausoleum. This fits into the antiquarian tradition of trying to associate
everything with an emperor.
With an emperor, yeah. Yes. So we don't know what happened to his body. And certainly under Maximinus, there is Damnatum Memoriae. You find his name and that name of his mother etched off inscriptions.
Mm-hmm.
However, after Maximinus's own death, spoiler alert, in 238, there is what we call the Year of the Six Emperors and the dynasty of the Gordiani. Gordian III, who ruled from 238 to 244, rehabilitated his memory, basically to pass over the aberration of Maximinus. Severus Alexander is then attested as a divus, the deified one. We see Gordian III trying to pass over the reign of Maximinus and trying to build links with the Severan dynasty and the good emperors of that dynasty, Septimius Severus, Caracalla as well.
Times change. Yes.
Well, don't forget, he was never condemned. He was the great Antoninus Pius.
Mm.
So not Elagabalus, but Severus Alexander is certainly rehabilitated as a divus. And in the reign of Trajan Decius in the early 250s, he issues a series of coins commemorating earlier deified emperors, including Severus Alexander.
Right. So just don't mention the Persian War.
Yeah, don't mention the Persian War. And there's a sense that he himself did not execute senators. You know, he didn't do all the wrong things.
He
didn't do the bad emperor things.
Yeah.
So therefore, he can be rehabilitated as one of the good emperors of the Severan dynasty.
So on balance then, and I suppose if you can think of this in the context of us sitting here a couple of thousand years later and Rome at the time, would they have thought of him as a good emperor? Was he a good emperor?
It's very difficult to evaluate Severus Alexander based on the sources. He himself emerges something of a cipher, someone who's just controlled by other individuals, by Ulpian, the Praetorian prefect, by his mother, Julia Mamaea. He does seem at least to have loved his wife, but that all ends badly as well. There's some sort of attempted palace coup there. We get the impression of someone who is manipulated by other forces. And although Herodian embellishes this into a narrative about aristocratic government versus tyranny, about a mild young man not set for warfare, I still think there is probably a kernel of truth there, the sense that a young man who comes to power at 14 can either choose the Elagabalus route and act out, or he could be someone who's very compliant and manipulated by other forces. And that's a pattern we see elsewhere in Roman history when young rulers, particularly in the late empire, are manipulated by powerful individuals around them. So Severus Alexander was a good ruler on one measure is that, you know, he didn't execute senators, didn't confiscate their property. He built public works. He was deferential to the Senate. He ticks all those boxes. But on the other hand, he clearly wasn't a strong leader.
Mm.
And that's what resulted in his downfall at the end.
I guess it's an unfair comparison, but if the Roman Empire never went to war then, if there was a nice peaceful time for his entire reign, a la Antoninus Pius, then he would have been a good emperor. He would have been fine for the Rome at the time. But what you need is somebody who's not just thoughtful, somebody who doesn't kill senators. I can't believe that that's a good thing that an emperor should aspire to. But also somebody that when the horn is blown, when war sounds, Marcus Aurelius spends most of his time on the front lines, still writing his philosophy, but taking care of the wars that need to be fought.
Exactly, and that becomes an expectation of the imperial office, that they are there on the frontier defending the empire. We mustn't forget that Severus Alexander, despite some of the upheavals with Ulpian and his wife, he was on the throne 13 years from 222 to 235. That's longer than Elagabalus, Macrinus, Caracalla.
Yep.
It's a good long reign, and he doesn't take the front until 231. So clearly, although we know very little about those years, something was working before they went off to the front. Yes, there were revolts, but they were put down. The empire was continuing. So who knows what had happened if he didn't have to go to the Persian front and didn't have to go to the German front, whether he might have married and had children, we don't know.
Looking at him through our modern lens, though, we very much seem to skewer at this is somebody who is just under the influence of, if not his mother, but all his advisors, somebody who couldn't make up his own mind, very indecisive. We seem to skewer more towards the Herodian interpretation.
Definitely, because that's our way of explaining what happened and what went wrong. That is the obvious answer to us as modern historians. And we shouldn't try and rehabilitate all emperors.
Otherwise,
all emperors start to look the same and they look bland and boring. But we should, you know, look at them and assess their good qualities and their bad qualities. And just as you said, assess them by the way the Romans would have assessed them, as well as how we look at them as leaders as well.
Now that we're saying that we shouldn't do that, but let's do that for the entire dynasty.
Exactly.
The Severan dynasty seemed very tumultuous, but could have been worse and could have been better. But on balance, considering what's to come for the Roman Empire, this was a pretty good time.
Yeah, it was a strong dynasty. It lasted from 193 to 235. Which is 43 years.
That's not long.
It's good to compare to what's come because of the number of emperors that Rome has between 235 and 284. Yes, it was not the time of Hadrian, Antoninus Pius, but we shouldn't take Antoninus Pius as some sort of peaceful baseline, because as historians have started to reevaluate, there were conflicts during his reign, not only in Britain, but also Dacia, Mauritania. Just as he died, you know, there are problems on the eastern frontier. So in a way, the fact that Antoninus Pius could sit in Italy for 20 years or so is an aberration. Someone like Domitian had taken to the front, Trajan had taken to the front, Hadrian toured the empire, and then Marcus Aurelius was forced to go and defend the empire on the Rhine and the Danube frontiers. So Rome is moving towards the idea that the emperor needs to be someone who's going to be an emperor for the entire empire, not just for Rome. We see that under the Severans, just as much under Marcus Aurelius. But the change is that Rome is not really waging any offensive wars anymore. With Septimius Severus's Parthian campaign, that was an offensive war to try and get him glory, designed to shore up his position as someone who had come to power in a civil war. He also tried to extend Roman territory in Britain, moving further up into Scotland. So you can cast Septimius Severus definitely in the model of a Trajan, someone who was trying to extend the boundaries of the empire. But then the later Severans, wars tend to be more defensive to protect the frontiers. particularly the humiliating peace treaty, which Macrinus has to reach, and then the two wars in Severus Alexander's reign to protect the Euphrates frontier as well as the Rhine frontier. And in the 3rd century, it's those pressures on the north and on the east that is going to keep Rome in a series of defensive wars throughout the 3rd century. So we are really in a transitional period where emperors can't quite be someone who's going to extend the empire and therefore extend the pomerium like Claudius and Trajan and Septimius Severus. We are going to turn to emperors who have to keep the Roman Empire together.
That's Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review, they are read and appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Kaelin on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it for the Severan Dynasty and for today's episode of Emperors of Rome. So until the next one, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.